Estimated that 4,100 named and unnamed students died in Canada's residential schools. We now present you an article written by Erica Violet Lee, a member of Thunder Child First Nation. Erica Violet Lee is a poet, scholar, and community organizer. The piece is titled, Native Children Didn't Lose Their Lives at Residential Schools, Their Lives Were Stolen. We'd all heard the stories long before they started to receive this summer's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week coverage by every news station in Canada. Long before ground-penetrating radars confirmed the presence of unmarked graves, we knew that our missing family members did not simply disappear, nor attempt and fail to run away from residential schools, despite what we were told by missionaries and government officials. Indigenous communities are necessarily close-knit, and we live in the histories of our people, despite every effort at the eradication of our knowledge, culture, and languages, and of our lives. Published in 2015, the final report of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, TRC, estimated that 4,100 named and unnamed students died in Canada's residential schools. To keep costs low, the report said many were probably buried in untended and unmarked graves at school cemeteries, rather than sending the students' bodies back to their home communities. Often parents were not notified at all, or the children were said to have died from sickness, an excuse commonly used to justify intentional genocide of Indigenous nations, predicated under supposed biological inferiority. My reserve community is Thunderchild First Nation, Saskatchewan, in the middle of the beautiful northern prairies. The institution intended for children from Thunderchild was called Saint-Henri, built in 1901 by the Roman Catholic Church. The creation of these residential schooling institutions was a direct result of Canadian policy aiming to remove Indigenous people from our lands and assimilate us into Canadian society. Neither the church nor the state is innocent in the continued genocide of our people. On 27th of May 2021, the graves of at least 215 Native children were officially uncovered at the former Kamloops Indian Residential School on Tekemloops, the Secwepemc First Nation, in the city of Kamloops in British Columbia. Less than a month later, 751 unmarked graves were located at Maryville Indian Residential School on Cowessess First Nation in Saskatchewan. 6 days later, 182 unmarked graves were located at the site of St. Eugene's Mission School in Cranbrook in British Columbia. As the days pass, more communities are unearthing such tragedies. The outcome of this long-awaited reckoning involves multiple Native nations across the land delving into their own soils, pursuing the stories we've all heard from our elders and knowledge keepers. Many of us understand everyday Canadian schools themselves to be violent institutions of assimilation and colonization. In my predominantly Indigenous urban elementary school in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, I grew up singing O Canada and God Save the Queen at assemblies. In the lunchroom, Johnny Appleseed, a biblical song about a Christian God's benevolence, was to be recited before we were allowed to eat our school-provided meals. Still, the terms residential school and the US equivalent boarding school are deeply inadequate. These residential schools, day schools, and boarding schools were actually prisons. These were forced labor camps. I recall hearing of Cree people, including small children, forced to work on sugar beet farms in brutal summer heat. This was a common practice from the 1940s to at least the 1980s. Farmers lured dispossessed and hungry indigenous people into seasonal labor with false promises, then forced the workers to labor 12 to 14 hours per day with little or no pay. They slept in trucks, in tents, or empty grain bins. If they ventured into nearby towns, they were chased away with bats. If they tried to leave, their children might be taken away from them. Some of the stories we're told about residential schooling prisons involve native children digging graves for other children. Rarely did our ancestors receive proper burials or grave markers. The soils of these lands have always known our hands as gardeners, as workers. These lands hold our bodies and the bodies of our ancestors. The soil that lies underneath so-called Canada has been hell, and it has been refuge. One thing is clear, native children's lives are never lost. They're deliberately and violently stolen. Similarly, the lands of indigenous people from Canada to the United States and beyond are never lost. They have been and continue to be forcibly colonized. The words we use matter for native life because these words define the past, the present, and the possible. Reckoning with the gentle language Canadians have been taught to use to describe the violence of empire is one part of the process of undoing colonization. In our communities, the accounting of Indigenous death feels relentless. We hear and see and feel the growing toll of graves uncovered. Ever higher numbers recited, seemingly hundreds of times daily, on nearly every Canadian news network. Endless repetitions of the phone numbers of residential schooling crisis lines to connect the grieving with mental health counselors. None of this is enough. I refuse to play the numbers game. Our grief and our lives are not reducible to numbers or to statistics. As a Twitter user, Awahite put it, Kamloops is not a unit of measurement. And to whose gaze are we appealing when we repeat these numbers over and over and over, hoping to evoke empathy from a settler state that cannot feel? Meanwhile, as Indigenous people, we are struck in the heart by those numbers every single time. There is simply no calculus that can account for the lives of each child stolen by colonialism's violence. All the moments of joy, curiosity, play, and learning that make childhood such a wondrous time, these things are immeasurable and immaterial. The lives experience of Indigenous childhood is irreducible to any European notion of property, and this is precisely why it is a threat to the colonial order. And what can the Catholic Church and the Canadian state do to repair the irreparable? The colonial institution of Canada will not reform itself, and it will certainly not end itself. Yet, there is one variable often left out of the calculation, our continued resistance. I think not only about the young ones who were stolen, but the childhoods that have been reclaimed by Indigenous resurgence and the all-encompassing love of our parents and communities. Indeed, our people are still stolen and killed. Indeed, our knowledge is suppressed, and our lands are colonized. In spite of this, what allows me to wake up in the morning and feel hope is all that we managed to save, all that which they could not take. Our languages and ceremonies were preserved and practiced undercover, hidden from the Indian agents patrolling our reserves, and parents camped in tipis outside those prisons, waiting to see their children. They never gave up, nor will we. The institution for children at my reserve, Thunderchild First Nation, in the middle of the beautiful northern prairies, was burnt down in 1948 by a fire set in the middle of the night. The fire was rumored to have been started by the children held in captivity at Saint-Henri. The institution was never rebuilt. Since time immemorial, many indigenous peoples around the world have used fire to rejuvenate the land and restore order to the natural world. The lesson is that sometimes things must burn for the soil to heal and become healthy once more. As monuments and statues to colonial figures are toppled, and as black and indigenous communities continue to resist and heal, another world is becoming possible. In the next world that we are building on these lands, our ancestors knew so well, no child will have their formative years violently stolen away by colonialism. They will be free, and we will be free.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. When it comes to the JCPOA or the Iran nuclear deal, one party has done its best to stay in the deal and stick to its commitments. That party is Iran. Unlike the European partners who have not lived up to their commitments, or the U.S. which pulled out of the deal altogether. Well, Iran now says that the U.S. needs to cease its violations of the 2015 nuclear deal without preconditions and drop its addiction to sanctions, stressing the Islamic Republic is not indebted to the other parties as it was fully committed to the agreement, though it did not reap the benefits of the accord. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the survival chances of this deal.
Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency says until U.S. sanctions are not removed, no one should expect more forbearance from the Islamic Republic. Kazem Gharibabadi told the IAEA's Board of Governors, Iran's nuclear activities, including enrichment at high levels and production of metallic-based uranium fuel, are completely peaceful, under IAEA safeguards, and in line with the country's rights under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
They asked Iran to go back to the full implementation of its commitment under the deal. So I said, no, it's not possible. So our nuclear program will continue. And if there are some specific actions that we have taken and are going beyond and are beyond the JCPOA provisions, we will suspend them only in case of lifting sanctions.
Gharibabadi criticized the European signatories of the deal for refusing to condemn the illegal unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. Apparently, he said, they intend to switch the places of victim and violator. talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the JCPOA have not resumed since June. The aim of the negotiations, in which the U.S. took part indirectly, is to bring Washington and Tehran back into full compliance. Iran says the outcome of talks to revive the nuclear deal should be the effective and verifiable removal of all U.S. sanctions and guarantee that disastrous decisions like the U.S. withdrawal and violations do not reoccur. Iran also informed the board that one of the IAEA's equipment was destroyed in an act of sabotage, widely blamed on Israel, targeting an Iranian nuclear workshop. It's regrettable, Gharibabadi said, that the agency has failed to take a clear position on such terrorist acts against the civilian nuclear facilities of its member states. Homolizki, Vienna.
All right, for this edition of the Spotlight, let me introduce our guests. We have Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author, who joins us from London. Also joining us is John Bosnich, journalist and political analyst, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let me first start with you, Marcus Papadopoulos, if I may. Let's take a look at the U.S. and the European demands, which go pretty much hand in hand, in a matter of speaking. They want Iran to stop its nuclear program, in which billions have been spent and remain under the strictest inspection regime ever, based on the IAEA's history, as far as it's been said. And it wants also Iran to stop its regional influence. It wants Iran to stop its rocket program. How should the Iran respond to these types of demands?
Well, that Joe Biden pursues an antagonistic approach towards Iran and the Iranian people demonstrates the delusional approach that many commentators in both America and in Britain took regarding Joe Biden, because these commentators hailed the man as a savior who would bring peace and stability to the Middle East. And such a sentiment really does amount to delusion and simple-mindedness, because Biden is as bloodthirsty as the Trumps, the Obamas, the Bushes, and the Clintons of this world in seeking to maintain and strengthen American global hegemony. And that includes in enhancing America's supremacy in the Middle East. And in relation to Iran, it should have been very obvious to commentators in both Britain and America that Joe Biden has no love for Iran, no love for the Iranian people, and no love for the Iranian revolution, because he has publicly declared himself on more than one occasion as, and I quote, a Zionist. Now, in relation to the JCPOA, this is really a matter of inversion at its most inverted, because ever since the JCPOA came into force in 2015, Iran has honored all of its obligations. That is quite simply an irrefutable actuality. Whether you like Iran or not, is absolutely irrelevant because, as I said, the Iranian authorities have complied with all of their responsibilities. America, however, as we know, in 2018, withdrew from the agreement. So the ball, so to speak, was in the court of the Europeans, specifically the British, the French, and the Germans, to ensure that the JCPOA continued to function. But alas, despite some promising talk from Berlin, Paris, and London since 2018, the stark reality is that the Europeans, coming under the influence of Washington, and especially the British, have started to accuse Iran of being the reason for why the JCPOA is not moving forward, which is absolutely outrageous. It is absolute nonsense. There is nothing more that Iran can do. Iran has dignity. Iran is a self-respecting state. It has remained a signatory to the treaty. The Americans have left. Joe Biden has no intention whatsoever of relieving, of rescinding the sanctions that Trump placed on Iran, because Biden loathes Iran as much as Trump does.
Okay.
Therefore, it is down to Europeans, but the Europeans are failing to actually fulfill their obligations to JCPOA.
John Bostich, this is what the Iranian ambassador to the IAEA has said. It is as if these countries have forgotten that it was Iran that complied with all its obligations under the agreement, yet did not enjoy the benefits due to U.S. law-breaking measures and the Europeans' inaction. Apparently, these countries seek to replace the victim with the lawbreakers. Who is the audience for the U.S. and the Europeans portraying Iran as being the one that's breaking the agreement, that's pulling out of the agreement, and not fulfilling its commitments?
Well, unfortunately, the public audience is the citizenry of the United States, because before the United States takes any military action or pinpoint strikes, as they call them, they usually soften up potential public opposition. So they are now attempting to paint Iran with the brush of a violator of an international agreement, which Iran is not. They are now enhancing the propaganda that Iran poses a severe and imminent threat to Israel, because there's a very strong pro-Israeli lobby in the United States. And at the same time, they are compounding the decades-long American demonization of Iran and the Iranian people. These are telltale signs of preparation for war. Unfortunately for the Americans, and fortunately for peace and for the people of Iran, both Russia and China have made it clear that they do not support this kind of illegal pressure on Iran. And in somewhat of a surprise, the normally totally gung-ho Europeans are even being a little bit soft in their cheering for their American masters, and they are holding back on calling for any further heightening of tensions. So, if Iran is successful, it can only be by reaching the public of the West, reaching the powers that be in Europe, where America is pushing people around too much, and hopefully letting the world realize that you cannot just say that something is a certain way if it isn't that way. Iran has complied.
But that's what they're doing.
Unilaterally withdrew. That's the fact.
But that's what they're doing. Let me come to you, Marcus Papadopoulos, to read to you the E3 statement here and ask your reaction. I'm going to go further down first. It says, we appreciate the intense efforts of the IAEA Director General to engage with Iran. We welcome the joint statement between the Director General of the IAEA and the head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, which confirms that IAEA's inspectors will be permitted to service the identified equipment. One positive paragraph, but then here we have Iran has no plausible civilian reason for such activity. Iran has started the process of doubling its production rate of high-enriched uranium Iran has continued to stockpile uranium enriched to 20%, and I'm just reading the first sentence of each paragraph that condemns Iran. So here you have Iran saying, okay, interim agreement, 3 months, kind of saying to the IAEA, here's another chance. Our cooperation as an NPT member, so forth, to show our true colors. But yet they come out with these types of statements. This has been the way that Iran has been painted all along, hasn't it?
Indeed. And I would take it much further. Ever since the Iranian Revolution, Iran and the Iranian people have been vilified. Indeed, the vilification of the Iranian people and of Iran is one of the worst that the West has carried out in contemporary times. But then there should be no surprise about that, because Iran firmly pursues an independent foreign policy. Iran will never, ever succumb to the threats and the diktats of Washington. And of course, Iran is the most important part, the most important cog in the resistance to Israeli aggression in the Middle East. And therein lies the reason why Britain, especially, but also regrettably France and Germany, being strategic partners of America, are taking this approach. But this approach would not stand up in a legitimate court of law, because only a few days ago, inspectors from the IAEA were in Iran, and they were taken around the various nuclear facilities in the country, and no restrictions were placed on them. And those inspectors, had they have had restrictions placed on them, they would have made this very clear to the rest of the world, but they didn't. However, the British, the French, and the Germans, acting on behalf of America, being strategic partners to Washington, are attempting to portray Iran as being the reason for why the JCPOA is faltering. Well, the fault lies firmly with America, specifically the sanctions that America maintains to this very day on Iran. Those sanctions which were placed on Iran by the Trump administration after Trump withdrew America from the JCPOA. If the Europeans were sincere, truly sincere in their commitment to the JCPOA, they would come out publicly and call on America to do two things. Firstly, to rescind the Trump-era sanctions on Iran, and secondly, to rejoin the JCPOA. But then the French and the Germans really are not independent countries. They're only independent on paper. And that is a very painful reality. As for Britain, well, of course, Britain and America form the nucleus of the Anglo-Saxon world. So that is why the British are adopting this very deceitful and very menacing approach to Iran in relation to JCPOA.
Okay. Well, as of the latest, if this is accurate enough for it to be the latest, you have the U.S., John Bosnich, that has said that it is prepared to remove sanctions on Iran to resume compliance with the Iran nuclear deal, including those that are inconsistent with the 2015 pact. And, quote, we are prepared to take the steps necessary to return to compliance with this. The problem is that there's so many sanctions that the U.S. has placed that it's in the hundreds, especially when Trump was in power, that Iran says those have to be lifted, period. So you have somewhat of a dead end in that respect. The U.S. keeps saying what it wants to say. Iran says you have to remove the sanctions. Do you think that the U.S. is consistent in its demand, knowing that Iran's not going to accept it, because it thinks that at some point Iran's going to give in, like a chess game here?
Well, it's definitely standard American policy. It's making demands on Iran, knowing that Iran was in compliance with the agreement, blaming Iran for America's unilateral withdrawal from the agreement. It's on the face of it, it's obvious that America is in the wrong. So when Germany, France, and England all continue to push the American line, it is an underlining of the fact of what Mr. Papadopoulos told us just a few moments ago, that these are not really independent countries, these are just puppet states. And as puppet states, they function as the mute dummy into which the ventriloquist is casting his voice. And the ventriloquist is Washington. Washington sends its voice over to its puppet leaders in these three countries, and they recite whatever they're told to do. If I were in Iranian government, I would be completely ignoring anything that they say. And I would also take into account another good point by my fellow commentator today, that the origin of this entire confrontation with Iran is not America, but Israel. And so we've got a double layer of control which you cannot penetrate because they are not responsive to your activities. And the only and the best solution is for Iran to replace the business that it did with America with business with other countries which are fair players by international law. Iran should turn even more than it has towards China. Iran should reserve all of its oil reserves for countries which are not destroying its entity as a country, and Iran should reorient its politics and its international affairs to avoid this. And I can give you the example of Russia that was under U.S. sanctions for decades, and we now know that Russia has developed its own farming industry, Russia has developed replacement products, and has become more economically viable after cutting off its relationship with the unfair dealers, and that's America and its colonies. So there is a time of trial ahead, but if Iran stays the course of being an independent country and not taking foreign dictates, you will be much better off than bowing to these foreign pressures.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, Iran has done what John Bostich has said there, a 25-year deal with China that was revealed months ago. It is getting very close to Russia. It's Ebrahim Raisi, Iran's president, in his first overseas trip. He's going to be traveling to Tajikistan, I believe, for the SCO summit, which since 2005, Iran has had an observer status, but it is pretty much confirmed that it's going to now be a member. So you have that movement there. At the same time, you have a new president and a new administration and a new lead negotiator. Abbas Araghchi was replaced just in the past 24, 48 hours. You have the Ali Bagheri who has replaced him. And one analyst has said about Ali Bagheri, his appointment should be seen as a clear warning to the West, as it's likely that the new team will throw into question the whole basis of the nuclear deal and maybe abandon all of Iran's commitments if the Americans delay the return to the 2015 agreement. That is one analyst. That is not the government line. But Ali Bagheri's stance before is pretty much clear how he has been against the JCPOA because it's not the benefits are not there as he sees it. Do you think that the U.S. administration is going to be on watch here to heed this new administration and maybe have be lenient and remove sanctions for starters?
Well, let me say, first of all, that under no circumstances will America rescind any of the sanctions it currently has on Iran, including the sanctions placed on Iran by the Trump administration and the sanctions which preceded Trump coming to power. Indeed, the sanctions which go back to the 1980s. America's official goal is to destroy the Iranian revolution. It is to bring the Iranian state tumbling down, to return Iran to a client state. The state as it was during the days of the Tsar, or of the Shah, when it was subservient, submissive to both America, Britain, and Israel. But let me go one step further in regard to Iran's relationship with Russia. It is not simply the case that Iran has a very close political relationship with Iran. No, Iran has a strategic partnership with the Russian Federation, and that is extremely important. Indeed, that in the last few years has changed the dynamics of the Middle East, because it means that Iran has a strategic relationship with one of the two superpowers in the world, as I said, namely Russia. That means that Iran's national security is extremely augmented as a result, and secondly, it gives the Iranian government even more confidence when pursuing its foreign policy objectives, not just in the Middle East, but across the wider region. And I believe that it is that, rather than the new administration in place in Tehran, that is a source of consternation for America, because America sees the Middle East as having a new, although unofficial, alliance in it, an unofficial alliance comprising Russia, Syria, and Iran. Mm-hmm. The Americans know that their supremacy in the Middle East is not going to be ended by this unofficial alliance between Moscow, Damascus, and Tehran. Nonetheless, it is causing a lot of anxiety, sure, a lot of worry for American policymakers. So it's not the case that the Americans are concerned about the new Iranian president and his new administration. It's the fact that Iran has a strategic partnership with Russia, like how America has a strategic partnership with Israel.
Sure. Last question, John Bosnich. You talked about how certain things that was being discussed or that you were saying are signs that this is going to lead up to war. Now, how could that happen if the U.S. is pretty much leaving the West Asian region, the Afghanistan debacle that happened, the pullout there, to focus on China, which it has been doing for some years now? Do you think that the U.S. is in any position to do something like that?
Okay, well, first things first, next door to the place where I'm here now in town is making a bit of noise, so I'm going to speak over them. The defeat of America in Afghanistan has opened the door for new American wars. It is not an end to the American war program. And Iran has been on the American target list for years. So I would suggest that this is a very dangerous time, and Iran has to be very, very careful about what America threatens to do. And remember that Israel is always ready to send America to war against Iran. I think that this is a dangerous time, but I do believe that Iran has to stay the course, because the Iranian position here is the legal and correct position. I would suggest that you should tie preemptive legal action at the World Court. I think that these sanctions should be contested, and I believe that the United States should be put under every kind of international pressure, especially from friendly countries to Iran, including Russia and China, okay, so that America knows that if it does take aggressive action against Iran, it will not just be facing Iran, it will be facing a series of interested and very concerned countries around the world.
Thank you. I'm sorry to jump in. We're just fresh out of time. Let me thank our guest, John Bosnich, there, journalist and political analyst from Belgrade. Thank you for your comments, John. Also, Marcus Papadopoulos, historian, political analyst, and author from London. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tavli, the entire team here in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BAT 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent Grist analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Adam Mahoney, writer. This article is published under the heading, Detroit's prison population will soon be stuck living next to a toxic site. Stay tuned for more. For decades, Detroit renewable power had burned 3,000 tons of trash every day, emitting dangerous levels of nitrogen oxide, sulfur dioxide, carbon monoxide, and lead into the atmosphere, contaminating surrounding neighborhoods. RA had spent years fighting to close the toxic site. Between 2013 and 2018, the incinerator racked up more than 750 citations for exceeding pollution emissions standards from the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, or MDEQ. And according to a local environmental law center, the incinerator violated the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency's Clean Air Act over 100 times as well. Data from the EPA and MDEQ shows that the facility is located in one of Wayne County's worst neighborhoods for air pollution, a community that is also 76% people of color and 71% of low income. After being released, Ra and her colleagues succeeded in getting the incinerator shut down in 2019. The closure doesn't completely eliminate the environmental threat, however. Studies have shown that contaminants emitted during waste incineration have the ability to infiltrate surrounding soil and groundwater, but impacts that persist for years even after a site is closed. Now, Detroit officials say a new jail complex is needed to address safety concerns in the city's aging jails, as well as save on maintenance costs. But the city's plan to construct the Wayne County Criminal Justice Center across the street from the old Detroit Renewable Power Incinerator will force up to 2,400 incarcerated people to live in close proximity to the facility's toxic legacy. While trash is no longer being burned on site, Detroit Renewable Power is still operating as a solid waste transfer station, taking in 1,000 tons of waste per day. Transfer waste stations are known to emit odors, cause noise, attract rodents, and cause air emissions both from unloading dry and dusty waste and increased traffic in the immediate neighborhood. Down the street from the new jail site, just beyond the recently shuttered incinerator, is a hazardous waste treatment plant known to fill the air with a rotting fish smell, which over the past 6 years has itself received more than 20 pollution violations from MDEQ, now called the Michigan Department of Environment, Great Lakes, and Energy. The waste treatment plant's violations are primarily for pungent odors released into the neighborhood, but also for dust and soot emissions beyond the state limits. Local residents say the emissions often make simply being outside unbearable. The jail site is also right next to I-75, a major highway, adding another source of noise and air pollution that inmates will be exposed to. Living in Detroit has given me a deep understanding that fights against the prison system and police are also fights against poverty and pollution, Raw told GIST. The close ties between incarceration and pollution seen in Detroit are replicated across the United States. A recent GIST analysis found that the nation's three largest jail systems, including Los Angeles, New York, and Chicago, have facilities disproportionately located in areas where there are elevated risks for pollution-related cancer, respiratory hazards, diesel pollution exposure, and proximity to toxic wastewater and hazardous waste. According to the EPA, those incarcerated within the new Wayne County Criminal Justice Center will be exposed to more diesel pollution and situated closer to hazardous waste than 90% of the country. The jail's location on Detroit's east side within a heavily polluted area wasn't in the original plans. The project, which first got underway in 2011, was initially slated to be built in downtown Detroit, close to public transit. But after the city ran over budget on the jail, construction paused. Officials made a deal with Dan Gilbert, co-founder of Quicken Loans, a company accused of fraudulent lending, and founder of Bedrock, a real estate business, both of which fall under Gilbert's parent company, Rock Venture, which includes over 100 other affiliated businesses. The deal was that Gilbert would receive the original downtown jail site in return for providing funding to continue the project at a new location on Detroit's east side, and that Bedrock would manage the construction of the facility. This arrangement underscores the way that environmental and criminal justice have become entangled in the new Wayne County Criminal Justice Center. It's being funded in part by a private investor, Gilbert, who has been charged with gentrifying Detroit, the blackest large city in America, and displacing residents in the process, as apartment buildings across the city were forcibly vacated for redevelopment. Never before has a private entity held so much influence in a major American city as Rock Ventures holds in Detroit, Business Insider declared in 2018, and no one in the private sector is as powerful as Gilbert. According to city officials, the jail will save taxpayers money in the long run and is needed to improve safety for those incarcerated. The new complex will replace three existing prison facilities that are spread across the city, a setup that requires inmates to be transported from the jail to courtroom for every legal appearance. The new centralized Wayne County Jail will have a court on site so that those awaiting trial will walk to court rather than being driven. From the consolidation of the buildings and the resulting decrease in building maintenance and staffing costs, the new jail is expected to save taxpayers $10 million to $20 million annually. Environmental justice organizers argue the money could be better spent elsewhere. Instead of putting forward hundreds of millions of dollars into prisons, we should be putting hundreds of millions of dollars into schools, said Michelle Martinez, executive director of the nonprofit Michigan Environmental Justice Coalition. Detroit's public schools are notorious for environmental health hazards like periodically unsafe drinking water, as well as mold and heating and cooling issues. A new distribution utility plant will also be built to service the new jail, another $35 million the county will pay for. Detroit residents, community leaders, and environmentalists have raised concerns about the new location of the jail since its announcement, citing its proximity to a hotbed of industrial pollution, taxpayers taking on additional debt to finance the jail, and the inconvenience for visitors and criminal justice officials since the district court will still be located downtown. Despite multiple interviews, requests to the Wayne County Executive Office and Wayne County Commissioners, no one from the county was able to confirm whether or not an environmental impact statement or assessment was conducted before building the jail.
This is the voice of the